I'm Mike Webb, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. Today, ProPublica and The Atlantic magazine published an investigation by our senior editor, Robin Fields, about the dialysis system in America. The piece attempts to understand why we have among the highest mortality rates in the industrialized world when we also have the highest cost for treatment, amounting to $20 billion a year paid by U.S. taxpayers. Robin is here with us to discuss the story. She was an award-winning reporter who helped break the Norman Sue political fundraising scandal story, as well as investigations about California's adult guardianship system and abuses by the J. Paul Getty Trust. She joined ProPublica as a senior reporter after stints at the Sun Sentinel and the Los Angeles Times, but we thought so highly of her work that she was soon promoted to senior editor. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thanks, Mike.
Before we begin, I want to note that Robin will also be interviewed on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and you can listen to that program at npr.org/freshair. They're going to cover some of the substantive points in the piece, and we're going to focus on the reporting process. So, Robin, I do want to talk to you about the overarching point of the story, that this attempt at universal coverage for dialysis patients has not lived up to its original promise. What happened?
Well, Mike, I think that they set out to create access, and they've absolutely been able to do that. But they've struggled mightily to ensure quality and control costs. That's turned out to be far harder. Even defining quality has turned out to be hard.
Is that partly because more people are in the program than they ever expected?
Far, far more, and far different people than they ever expected. The patients that poured in after the program was created were older and, to some extent, sicker. Epidemics of obesity and diabetes have greatly increased the patient population beyond all imagination.
Near the end of the story, you wrote that there are some obvious things that Washington could do to help improve the system. Can you give us a couple examples?
Well, one thing that we have talked about in the story is that they haven't really fulfilled the potential to create more empowered patients by giving patients more information. They have more data than they've released, and we've been urging them to do that. Another thing that they can do is they can define quality in ways that they haven't before. They've really tended to define it, limiting it to a couple of biochemical markers that are based on lab tests. Whereas many patient advocates feel it ought to be based more on the bottom line of mortality, hospitalization, and perhaps even more important than that, patients' quality of life.
Right. Okay. Keeping them healthy would keep the cost down as well?
Yes. And the other thing that we could look harder at, and one of the things that we talk about a lot toward the end of the story, is how to integrate this sort of unique healthcare experiment and entitlement with the other parts of the healthcare system. One of the big things that hobbles this system is that patients come into it in very poor shape.
Why does that happen? Are they afraid to approach a doctor? Do they not know?
Often they are underinsured or uninsured. The dialysis population is disproportionately made up of minorities and people who are on the poorer end of the socioeconomic scale. These are people who often don't get care until they're in a crisis.
Why would the government keep them in the dark on the data? It seems like they'd make better decisions the more they know.
The government has released a limited amount of data, and I think that they've given a couple of reasons for why they haven't released more. One is that some of the data that they haven't released isn't as refined as they'd like it to be and is somewhat disputed as to whether it includes enough risk adjustment to help people understand why there may be differences in outcomes between one clinic and another. Ultimately, though, this is data that the government itself has used for years. It's data that's given to providers with the purpose of helping them do better and to use as a tool. And I guess the question that we've asked is, if it's good enough for them, why wouldn't it be good enough for patients?
Well, let's talk about your reporting process. With this being such a sensitive subject, how did you approach your interview subjects to let them know how they were going to be featured in the story? And is it a journalist's responsibility to their sources and subjects to inform them how they're being portrayed in the piece?
I think it is, and I think it's not only a responsibility, but it works in your favor to lay your cards on the table for all kinds of sources, whether they're people who are relatives of patients or if they're providers where you may be saying something difficult for them to hear about their own service or company. I think it's important to lay your cards on the table and to give people every opportunity to tell their side and also to tell you something that you might not know.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they're more forthcoming the more interactions you have with them?
Not necessarily. I think that sometimes there are cases where they're limited in their ability to provide you with information because of patient privacy rules or because, frankly, they may not see an upside to giving you more information. I think that the act, though, of offering them that opportunity, first of all, is the right thing to do, and second of all, almost always increases the quality and fairness of whatever you write.
I know that you looked at the inspection records for 1,500 clinics in California, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. How did you go about getting those reports, and what did you find in those?
The process of getting the reports was difficult only in that it was a huge tonnage of records, and most of the states hadn't dealt with anyone asking them for all of their records over a span of time. In several cases, I actually went to the states to look through their records. And I think that the purpose of doing that was just to try to get your hands around what's going on at 5,000 clinics across the country. It's very, very difficult. You could try to go to clinics and observe, and we did some of that. But you can only be in a particular place at a particular time, and you don't get a sense of what the overall looks like and what kind of patterns the people who are trained to observe whether these places are operating the way they should see when they go in. Mm-hmm. What we found was that there were patterns of issues and problems that emerged from those reports. Errors, breaches of infection control procedure, overall conditions being unsanitary or unclean, the kinds of conditions you would not expect to find in a healthcare setting, and particularly a healthcare setting that routinely services such fragile patients with such fragile immune systems. Certainly, we didn't find that about every clinic. There are clinics that are doing superlative work and are extremely caring and extremely exact in the care that they give. But having that wealth of data from the inspection reports, the kinds of things that we talk about in the story did begin to pile up.
You wrote about the two big companies that really service a lot of dialysis patients versus the more, I'll characterize them as mom and pop treatment centers. Were those the ones that did you find more problems with the bigger treatment centers?
I don't think we tried to parse it out like that, because I think one of the things that was striking was how these types of events could occur almost in any clinic that we looked at, any type of clinic, I should say. It wasn't limited only to chains. It certainly wasn't only limited to independents. It wasn't exclusively for-profit or exclusively non-profit. One of the things that was interesting was we tried to achieve a certain kind of geographical balance in the states that we chose to examine most closely.
What do you mean? By the biggest cities or?
Well, when we were looking at those states, we were looking at the entirety of those states. But mm-hmm. We tried to pick states that were in all regions of the country and also states which in some cases had more independent facilities versus more chain facilities. We looked for diversity there. And we also looked to make sure that we didn't look at anything that could be considered a small sample. I think that we didn't want to overgeneralize, but at the same time, we didn't necessarily find one provider or one type of provider that jumped out.
Okay. Was transparency an issue? I know that there's going to be a sidebar where you look at two different clinics and how they reported, how they shared their information.
One of the things that we talk about in the story is that there's facility-level outcome and performance data that the government hasn't released. And we asked the question, well, if you had that information, what would you know that you can't know now? And we were able to obtain some of the data for Texas over a three-year period. And what we found, looking at, for example, two clinics in Houston, was that the information that was in the confidential reports showed that there were quite a number of differences between them that you wouldn't have observed if you only had the data that was on the public site.
I know that you've been working on this story for a while, on and off. Why did it take so long to pull this story together?
I think a couple of reasons. One was that I was working on other things at the same time or intermittently, that where I would basically be working on something else for 6 or 7 months at a time. And that's a strange way to do a story like this. I've never really done that before. I also think that last year it was a difficult time to do a story about healthcare that wasn't directly related to the very political conversation that was going on about healthcare reform.
Right. Is it harder for you to sort of keep your thoughts where you're going with your investigation if you kind of get sidetracked by editing a piece or something that's unrelated?
I think that it is a different kind of a reporting rhythm than you have if you're just inside a story the entire way. In a way, it's a relief to get away and then come back. And I think it does give you some perspective about what rises out of your material that you might not have otherwise. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
Right. But it's interesting to me that when you walk away, you come back to it with fresh eyes.
I also think that I was able to talk to a huge range of people in this area over a stretch of time and go back to some of the same people again and again. And I think that really helped me in terms of gaining a deeper understanding of the system and all the stakeholders in the system and their thinking.
I want to ask, why is this a ProPublica story?
I think it's a ProPublica story because it does say something that will be revelatory to many people. This is an area that only the people in it are very familiar with some of the things in this story, mm-hmm. but the wider world probably finds this an area quite easy to ignore. And yet, I think it takes us into an area that is instructive on a broader level about healthcare and about what it takes to get healthcare right. I also think that it exposes some things that have happened to people that are just that the types of things that shouldn't happen. And that's a big part of what we do.
Thanks for joining us, Robin. You can listen to Robin on Fresh Air starting on Tuesday, November 9th from 3 p.m. on. And you can also read the entire investigation and follow-up reports at ProPublica.org/dialysis. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Qadiya Muhammad. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll see you next week.